Well, hello and welcome to what is a podcast special on what is going to be Adoption Sunday. So I'm here on my own, but I've got a guest, Emily. Hello, Emily.
Hello.
Hello, this is Emily Christou. And where do you come from and who are you working for?
My role is Head of Advocacy, and that is within the organisation Home for Good.
So it's Adoption Sunday. Can you tell me, well, before we go any further, I need to say that Scott would have been loved to have been here, but it's actually, he's in the Andaman Sea on his own version of Tracy Island. He's got a private retreat to be bought on island, you know, with his with the money from Adoption UK, and he just goes there as often as he can, basically. So it's just me this week, and Scott was totally cool with me doing this, because I guess before we go any further, I have to make a confession, is that I would consider myself to be a believer. So is that a confession? I suppose that is a confession. So I do have a vested interest, and I suppose I do have a bit of back knowledge on all things faithy and Christian-y. But I'll not say much more than that. I'll probably share as I go along my views and stuff. Right, tell me about Home for Good and tell me about Adoption Sunday.
Well, Home for Good is a fostering and adoption charity. We are spread across the UK, and we have an aim to find a home for every child who needs one. We predominantly engage through the Christian church, so engaging churches up and down the country, calling more people to step up to foster or adopt, and then encouraging the church to offer the wraparound support that those families will need. And my particular role is engaging with government and doing a sort of political facing work, hoping to bring about some of the systemic change that's needed for adoptive and foster families to thrive. Every year in November, we have what we call Adoption Sunday, which is a special campaign. It's a kind of church-facing campaign, and it's all about asking churches to mark the need for more foster carers and adopters, and to celebrate foster families and adoptive families and children that are in the care system or previously been looked after. So it's a church-facing campaign, and it's an opportunity for churches to celebrate something of adoption on a Sunday morning service, essentially.
Cool. I mean, that makes sense, and I suppose I know that question, but I guess it's helpful for people listening, perhaps. Already, I've had funny feelings about what you're saying, because I think that...
Yeah.
Well, I'm really conscious that we share language, and some elements are adoption and fostering culture with the US. And often when we're talking about faith and adoption and fostering, I see regularly across my Twitter feed, across my social media platforms and blogs, etc., a very different faith perspective on adoption and fostering. And so are you aligned with that kind of faith culture, or is there, you know, because I'm slightly nervous about that before we go on.
Yes. My take is that there are some difficult and troubling narratives in the adoption and fostering sector, both in the faith element of it and in the non-faith element of it.
Right.
So mixed feelings about how to talk about these adoption and fostering, mixed feelings about how much to talk about it, the ongoing challenges of being an adoptive or foster family, and so on. I think definitely in the faith space there are some big challenges about things that are said. Some of the narratives that are out there can be quite problematic. I definitely think that there's a cultural difference in the way that we talk about adoption and fostering here in the UK versus how it's talked about in the US. And I think as well, something you'll have talked about a lot on the podcast in the past is how the adoption and fostering narrative has changed over time.
Mm-hmm.
And how things are quite different today in 2019 to how they might have been some decades ago. I do wonder whether actually in the faith space, sometimes we can be a little bit slower to catch on to things, and
yeah.
Whether it's a bit of a hangover of some of that historical perspective as well. I think it's undeniable that there's been definite challenges in the way that the church and vulnerable children issues have interacted. So lots of people will...
Sorry, that was my phone twanging. I'll turn it off.
It's all right. Good ringtone. I think it's undeniable that there's been really negative interactions of the church and vulnerable children's issues over many decades. But then I think there have been other institutions as well that have had very negative interactions with one of
you've laid out
issues.
A whole raft of things there already, so you've sort of mentioned troubling issues, and I'm thinking immediately that we sort of, you stick your head above the parapet and say faith and fostering or adoption, people think child abuse, systemic child abuse. So that's one thing. People maybe would think about something like the Magdalene laundries, where young mums are kind of treated horrifically in relation to their faith, and their, you know, that they've become pregnant, and the abusive environment that they were then put into, spiritually abusive, physically abusive, emotionally abusive. So how does it, well, and there's, I guess we started sort of thinking about America as well, and so you mentioned some troubling cultures from there. What were you thinking specifically, or troubling narratives?
So I think some of the things that you've mentioned, so the way that things have been done in the past in America, and also some of the current practices, I guess when people think of adoption or indeed fostering, they perhaps have a vision of that through American movies. Sometimes the reality of it is not quite the same. I mean, even the Instant Family film that came out, I think, last year, you know, that was fairly accurate in some senses to what adoption or fostering, long-term fostering is like today, but in other senses it's not. And so there's quite a confused picture out there. And yeah, I think in the faith space has definitely been a challenge. I suppose my perspective on that would be a few things. One is that because things have gone wrong in the past, means that there's a really strong call to get it right now, and not to just shy away and think that, oh, gosh, that's such a toxic issue that we're just going to shy away from it and not engage in it anymore. I think you've got to restore things that have gone wrong and push on to get things right in the future, because it matters for children in the system that need families to come forward. So I think it would be wrong for the church to say, oh gosh, that's such a complicated issue, we're not going to engage with that one anymore, and step back and kind of relinquish all responsibility from it. I think it's much better to say, here are some things that have gone wrong in the past, and this is, you know, the responsibility we feel to do something. I think the other thing for me is that that the scale of the need is big, and so we need people from all backgrounds, all walks of life, different communities to come forward and to play their part. And so there is, you know, not every Christian is going to be right as a foster carer or an adopter, but some will make great foster carers and adoptive parents. And likewise, you know, if you were to look at different racial groups, the ethnicities, if you were to look at age demographic, if you were to look at any other kind of different cohort of the population, if you like, you would want all people from all different walks of life, all backgrounds, to consider whether they can play a part. And I suppose what Home for Good has got is a unique channel of communication, if you like, to church communities. And so we're calling up particularly Christians to foster or adopt, and anybody else that hears the message as well. And then there are other groups out there that would do the same. I think getting people from a whole range of different backgrounds into the system to provide the best homes possible for children is really important.
I mean, I guess that you are, because of the nature of you know, the demographics that you touch upon, I guess it's a certain type of people, but I'm going to pull you right back. I'm going to keep pulling you back to this because I'm digging around. So, but how does an organisation that says, because you're parachurch, aren't you? You're outside of the church, but you're across different denominations. How do you then make sense of that for people externally? Because I think within the church community, I have a clear understanding of that narrative, and I see it very differently. I've probably got a more I think within the church community we would look on those historic failings within the UK anyway. I mean, I suppose in some ways it's not fair to draw you in onto the rocks of the US faith-based adoption processes, you know, Bethany Christian Service, all that kind of hooey. Sorry to our American listeners. But within the UK, how do you then draw a line for people outside of that? Because you must meet people who you say, oh, well, we're a parachurch, we do this, we want to get people in, and they're immediately, their hackles go up, and they say, hang on, what the hell's the church getting involved for? Look at the history. How do you get the people to say that to you, or do they... Is that an attitude that you get met with?
It is. I've had it from you, Al. So that's what's going through my mind is, yes, there are people out there who've had that conversation with me. I remember having a cup of tea with you probably 18 months ago where we had this conversation. So yes, it is a perspective that I've heard before.
It is just me.
Just you. No, it's not just
my problem.
It's not just. There are people who either, you know, have a conversation with me face to face, or I see things on Twitter, or you know, other things that are out there, other conversations that are being had. There are people that are nervous about it, and rightly so. That, you know, these are children that we're talking about, and so anybody that's interacting with them, you know, we've got to have the absolute highest standards. And anything that talks about church and children in the same sentence, there will be people that bring a perspective in that is nervous, yep. Let's put it that way, or cautious.
So how do you reassure them? How do you reassure those people? Or can you?
Well, I reassure them through a number of things. So, for example, Christians go through the exact same process that anybody else would go through. So it's, you know, we have a social work system in the UK that is not biased to any faith, and it shouldn't be biased against any yep. faith or any other category of person. Christians, like anybody else, go through a very thorough assessment process, and rightly so. So they should. You know, these are children that we're talking about, and any potential future family for them should really go through the right level of questions. In the same way that if I had children and they were going to be cared for by someone else, I'd want to ask them a million questions before they went off to live with that family. And I think that's the right thing to do. And people of faith, people of no faith, all go through the same process in terms of becoming a foster parent or an adopter.
Which is fair.
And that's the right thing. Actually, some Christians feel particularly nervous. They think that their faith is going to be a barrier, and I'm not sure that is true. I think social workers sometimes see the potential, sometimes see that people with a faith background have good support structures in place, they have a local community that they're plugged into, and so on, and sometimes those things can be looked on favourably. Likewise, there are other things that social workers would challenge.
I can share with you that I was, when my Mrs C and I went to be approved, we were deferred a panel because of our faith. But I think that more was a reflection of that time, which again we're talking 20 years ago now, so social work is probably coming out of a more radical humanist position than it is now. And I think that I've seen more and more literature around just sort of a sort of an acceptance of people's faith and seeing it as a potential strength as well as a potential weakness, but that's true of anything, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's good to get underneath the skin of the motivation of people that are stepping forward.
Absolutely.
Regardless of whether they've got a faith background. And sometimes people's faith can be a good driver into this, and sometimes there is the other side of it where, particularly I think in the American context, where you do have that sort of rescue narrative that's an unhelpful motivational driver. Yeah.
Which is what, on Twitter, I'd sort of put out this a ridiculously simple question that was actually two questions disguised as one, because I'm not a researcher. I was rubbish at research at university. And the question was, a quick question, do you have a faith and did it influence your decision to adopt? And one of the comments back was sort of from Rathika saying, it concerns me when people go into it with a saviour mentality. And I still, if I'm honest, I still see that floats around. Not everywhere, but yeah.
There's an interesting nuance, I guess, between saviour mentality and altruistic motivation. And I think saviour mentality is definitely a problem. Having a slightly altruistic motivation, having a slightly altruistic motivation is often perceived to be a good thing. The reality being that with the level of need of the children in our care system and the level of needs that adoptive children have going forward, it's absolutely vital that we're finding the right parents for the child rather than the right child to fit a need for the parents. And so having an adopter who comes forward who says, I know that this child is going to have lots and lots of needs, but I'm putting myself forward to adopt this child because I think I can do some good for that child. I think that motivation is a good thing to harness. There is definitely a level above that, which is an adopter stepping forward to rescue a poor child from the care system, that's really problematic.
Because they heard a cracking sermon on a Sunday. Because I was looking at scriptures, and you can pull out scriptures out of thin air, really. And the language of adoption is really potent, isn't it? It's kind of woven into our belief system. You know, we are adopted as God's sons, into all of that kind of stuff. And my take on that, I suppose I should be asking you the questions rather than giving you my take. That's not how it works, is it?
Go ahead, I'm here to listen.
Yeah, it's all about me. So my question is that, do you think that we give a fair representation of what the Bible actually says about adoption? In comparison to, you know, comparing what the Bible says versus contemporary adoption.
Yeah. So I think that Christians who understand that in becoming a Christian, they have become part of God's family, that they have experienced something of adoption into God's family. When a Christian has understood that, the right response to that is to then offer the same welcome and hospitality to others. And so I think when we talk about adoption and the biblical mandate for adoption and so on, it's important to contextualize that within the rest of the Bible and the other narratives that sit alongside it. So about welcome and hospitality and taking up the cause for the vulnerable, being a voice for the voiceless, talking about the marginalized, those on the fringes of society, the fatherless, the widow, the orphan, and so on. And when you take the full picture, I think it feels a lot more comfortable than if you try and draw a direct parallel between adoption into God's family and adoption as we know it in 2019 in the UK context. I don't think we want to layer those two things too closely on top of one another, without also adding in those other elements about hospitality and welcome and the importance of family and the need to engage with the marginalised and so on. If you neglect those other things and you only focus on adoption, actually you do a real disservice to the vast majority of children and the needs that they have. And actually, if you were to be really kind of blunt about it, the majority of children in the UK care system do not need adoption. They need a family to step forward and offer them a loving place of welcome for as long as they need it and according to, you know, their specific situation. So the biblical mandate for Christians to be involved in this space is a lot broader than adoption in its narrow sense, if that is helpful.
That's really, really helpful, because I think I googled scriptures because I don't hold them in my head. I'm not a very good Christian. I told you it becomes a confessional. I'm not a particularly good Christian, but I know that there's scriptures that people go to, and they're kind of flag banner waving. The James 1:27. I'm reading it now. I'm not doing it from off the top of my head. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress and keep oneself from being polluted by the world. And I'm just interested in that word orphans, because actually in the UK we don't have very many orphans, do we?
The thing that you were making me think of as you were just talking there is, I don't know if you've read the book Factfulness, but our advocacy team at Home for Good read it recently and got quite hooked on it. And one of the things in that book is about the lonely statistic, that if you have one statistic on its own and you don't contextualise it, that can be quite problematic. Yeah. So if you take one statistic about, for example, girls are not, number of girls around the world who are not in education, it looks terrible. If you contextualise it with what it was 20 years ago, actually it looks pretty good. And so taking one Bible verse out of the Bible and not looking at the broader context is just the same, I guess, as taking one statistic without that context. I suppose what you're also making me think of is that these kind of flag, banner Bible verses get used by loads of different organisations and to mean loads of different things, to be honest. Yeah. So one of the Bible verses we talk about a lot is Psalm 68, which is about God sets the lonely in families. Now, we think of family being, you know, people that are committed to you for your life. You don't age out of a family. But in another area of our work that we work in, which is to do with orphanages, there are models around the world that will use that exact Bible verse to justify a model of care for children that I might question as to whether or not that truly is family. I guess that's one of our challenges, is if we use an individual Bible verse, we can probably twist it to match whatever sort of concept we want to back up.
In some ways, because we use the word adoption for adoption, we don't then question the systemic stuff that goes with that in the UK right now. The temptation is to think, well, the Bible says we are all adopted as God's sons into his family, all of that, that stuff. But then we just presume all of the systemic stuff that comes with adoption, so the severance of identity, the removal from the home, the kind of the legal changes, all of that kind of stuff. We just accept that, well, that's adoption. But the Bible has nothing to say on that. In fact, the Bible has a lot to say on that. I was reflecting on this, and I remember when I was a good Christian and I read the Bible in a year, I remember the really boring bits, because God is red hot on genealogy, isn't he? He loves it. He loves family. He loves that descendancy. It's massively woven into identity. And this tish tash tosh that's always talked about, you know, Moses is mentioned as an adoptive child. Yeah, but his mother looked after him. So actually that's not adoption. And this is my favourite kind of adoption stuff. As an adoptive dad, so the whole thing where Mary and Joseph lost Jesus in the temple for 9 days, terrible parenting. And so obviously Joseph is Jesus's adoptive father. And eventually they track him down, don't they? They go to the temple and he's sat in the temple. He's having a chat to all these wise people. And Joseph says, me and your mother have been looking for you. And Jesus turns around and says, I was in my dad's house. Now, as an adoptive dad who's been repeatedly told that you are not my real dad, I am conscious that that is a really clear statement from an adopted child to a adoptive dad. You're not my real dad. Don't forget that sunbeam. You know, and Jesus, you know, and that. And I think that all of that stuff is stepped over, because at times church just goes, adoption is a good thing because we sing songs about it. So we accept it hook, line, and sinker. We accept the system, the systemic stuff, which kind of moves me on to the next stuff, because I know that your specific field or your kind of department. Do you have a department? Do you have underlings in your department? Minions?
Well, I wouldn't describe it as a department, underlings or minions, but yes, there is an advocacy team, and yes, there are other people within my team.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so you're being very humble, but you're probably in charge, aren't you? Tell me, because that this is the stuff that I find really interesting, and for me as a Christian, having kind of lived it a bit, I'm quite interested in the work that you then go on, because actually it feels like you're looking into these grey corners, the stuff around identity, the stuff around. On the first basis, this idea of trying to find a different sort of justice. So tell me about over the summer, there was the all party select group.
All party parliamentary group, yeah.
All party parliamentary, yeah, right, okay. Tell me, I mean, to a layperson, what even is that? How do you get one? How do you form it? Do you form it? Do they just grow in the wild?
No, they don't, sadly. So, as you said, I guess the more that Home for Good steps into this space of fostering and adoption, the more that we call people up to foster or adopt, the more that we're calling the church into the space, the more we want to be at the forefront of bringing about the systemic change that is needed in order to really help foster and adoptive families thrive and children to have the best possible lives and futures and well-being that they can have. And none of your listeners will think that everything is kind of fine and dandy in the fostering and adoption world. There are loads and loads of systemic issues. One of the things we at Home for Good really want to do is to partner with other people who have an interest in this space. And that's what's happened with the APPG, the All Party Parliamentary Group on Adoption and Permanence. Snappy title, I know. And so the background to that is that we came across a Labour MP, actually, who was very passionate about adoption. She'd spoken to adoptive families in her constituency up in York, and she felt that there was more that needed to be done to change the systems to help adoptive families to thrive. And she approached us and asked whether or not there was something we could do together. She was particularly interested in whether or not she could form an APPG on the issue. And so together with Adoption UK, we formed this group. Essentially what they are like, the way I would describe them are a bit like clubs or societies at university. So you've got literally one for every topic under the sun, from beer to gambling to waterways to carbon monoxide and so on, everything so under the sun, you can imagine.
Groups that are formed by MPs to kind of raise issues.
Exactly. Yeah, cross-party groups. The purpose of them is to raise the issue within both Houses of Parliament, Commons and the Lords. And the members of them are either MPs or peers from the House of Lords. And so we, together with Adoption UK and together with this MP and a number of other MPs and peers, formed the new APPG on Adoption and Permanence. I think I'm right in saying that it was formed around April of this year. And we sort of got going with thinking about what are the issues that we really want to raise the profile of in the House, which are the issues that we want to get more kind of political backing for. And at that point in time, there felt to be a real threat to the future of the Adoption Support Fund. So the government had guaranteed its funding, I think, until 2020, but people were really uncertain as to whether or not it was going to continue. It felt as if the jury was out about felt as if the jury was out in terms of whether it was working, whether it was going to continue, and so on.
And there's a huge anxiety around that within the community, wasn't there? I mean, it wasn't just a I wonder what will happen. It was a genuine. I spoke to people who were really anxious and concerned because saw it as a kind of a prop in their lives that they couldn't think how to replace.
And I think, you know, there were therapists who were stopping taking on new cases because they weren't sure about the future. There were families that were partway through therapy. So it was messy and complicated. And definitely there was a lot of fear kind of across the adoption sector, if you like, about the future of it. So together with Adoption UK and with the members of the APPG, we kind of conducted a bit of a rapid inquiry. We did a survey of 1,600 people. I think about 300 to 400 of those were young people themselves, adopted people. And we had evidence sessions in the Houses of Parliament. In those sessions, we had kind of sector representatives, academics and so on, but we also had some young people who had received support through the fund. And I guess what we managed to do, I think, is produce a report that made quite a strong case for the future of the fund, but also made some recommendations about things that might need to change going forward.
Because I think that's interesting to me, because I think that the discussions I had and the conversations I heard were that the Treasury wants to be confident that people are not just kind of, it's just not a pot of money that's going to be there forever, that actually that local authorities and adoption support agencies are actively looking at ways to use it wisely, to kind of reach a point of sustainability, to develop the evidence base about its effectiveness. And so you created this report that was then became like a crowbar to take. You took it up to the big house, did you, and presented it to the children's minister? Was that Nadeem Zahawi at that time?
It was.
Yeah. And was it well received?
I think he had 5 days left in his role before he was then moved on. So we launched the report. At the time, it was Nadeem Zahawi's children's minister, and we had Steve Reed, the shadow children's minister from the Labour Party, was there as well. a number of people from the DfE, and I think the general feeling was that it was a really useful report. It kind of made a strong case. It's quite helpful for the DfE to take something to the Treasury to say, actually, there's kind of, you know, a lot of buy-in and interest in this particular thing. We wanted the government to think that it was going to be a win for them to keep the fund, that people were watching and would hold them to account if they scrapped it. But also people were watching and were grateful for it and were going to thank them. And that was a political win for them. So I don't normally spend my life trying to make life easy for the government. But actually on this one, it did feel like a win-win, you know. It had been a positive intervention, and the government needed to know that, but also needed to know how to improve it as well, I think.
So what, I mean, where are we at now? Because people have seen that it's been, the review is kind of an interim review this year, IG review year. So in some ways, did it misfire, or is it just going to kind of be refreshed?
Yeah, so I think it's one of the many, many things that has been sadly affected by Brexit. So at the point at which we wrote the report, we were still expecting the government to do a 5-year comprehensive spending review. And so we were hoping that the government would make a commitment of at least 5 years, if not 10 years, to the future of the fund. Yeah. And that's how we structured the recommendations. Actually, the government didn't have their 5-year comprehensive spending review. They had a 1-year review, and pretty much the idea was business as usual, status quo.
Come back in a year and we'll talk about it.
Exactly, yeah. And so I guess what's really good about the report is that rather than us just having had a couple of interesting meetings and then a few kind of corridor conversations with some civil servants, because there's a report, there's a kind of tangible, you know, that report will still be there in a year's time, and the content will all still be there, and the people who contributed through the survey, their voices will still be there. And we will pick it up and keep kind of pushing on to see the future of the fund sustained. And also, we do want to see some of those things tweaked and improved as well.
That's really interesting, because I think that on one level, Home for Good don't particularly do anything, do you? I mean, you don't produce anything. That sounds terrible. But
go on, try again.
I'm not going to try again, because I'll stand by that. I'll defend that position. Well, in the sense that you don't provide any services, and you're not an adoption agency, you're not a fostering agency, you work in partnership with a lot of people, but you're not, it's a slightly different model. But I'm intrigued by this idea. Well, there's two things, and I'm conscious I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I guess, so thinking about Adoption Sunday, what are you actually trying to achieve? Is it just raising awareness and trying to make people think? Or is there more than that?
Adoption Sunday is definitely about trying to raise awareness. Right. It's trying to communicate to Christians around the country that there is a great need for more foster carers and adopters, and for better support for those families who are fostering or adopting. And we think that the church can play a part in both calling up more people to foster and adopt, and also in providing wraparound support that families need. So it's definitely an awareness raising exercise.
Yeah, that's a great kind of, that's the standard, isn't it? That's this what says on your banner. That's it.
Yeah.
But what about this more nuanced stuff, this kind of campaigning element that you do, which is, because I know that even, I saw some criticism over the summer on Twitter. There was a bit of a mini Twitter storm where people were, I don't know what the people are, people get upset very easily on Twitter. Sort of asking questions about the campaigning work you're doing, and, you know, the work we're doing with parents or the children of who are adopted. So is that something that fits into the Adoption Sunday and the message, you know, the message about adoption support, the other stuff you're doing around, you know, black and ethnic minority children, about, you know, children living in the children who are not in registered foster care homes. So is that stuff that feeds into Adoption Sunday, or is Adoption Sunday just kind of that banner, this is the message, or is it?
Well, Adoption Sunday takes a slightly different form each year. So this particular year, it's got a focus on kind of taking up the cause, and the ask of churches is for them to run what we call our foundations course after Adoption Sunday. We in the advocacy team have a whole host of different campaigns that we're engaging with. So one is the Change His Future campaign, which we launched last week as part of National Adoption Week, or the week before, rather. And we, some of our church engagement team will talk about those issues when they go into churches. So one of my colleagues was in a what we would call a black majority church down in Bristol on the weekend, and she talked about the Change His Future campaign because it was relevant to that audience, and we're trying to get the message out there to churches. So Adoption Sunday is just one of the things in our calendar that is by all, you know, not at all the only thing we do in terms of talking to the church about these issues.
Because that's a really, that is a specific issue that I've been asking questions a lot about. And every time I meet some different people, I say, well, we don't know, there's a lot of stuff we don't know about, you know, children of colour. We don't know where they go. We don't know where they end up. And sort of that everyone goes, yeah, I know. And then sort of local authority number crunches are reluctant to do the work. What are you trying to achieve? Are you just trying to raise, are you just trying to get more, you know, adults of colour to adopt more children of colour, or is there a more nuance to that?
Much more nuance. So yes, we want more people from all different backgrounds to step forward to foster or adopt, but we really want to get underneath the skin of this issue around why is it that BME children are waiting longer for adoption. And actually what we've discovered in recent weeks is that black children are 4.6 times less likely to get adopted. And
what does that even mean, though? Because that's I'm not a statistician. What does it mean?
When compared to a white child, their chances of being adopted, it's 4.6 times less likely that they will go on to be adopted. Another way of looking at it is that within the care system in England, black children make up about 7 or 8% of the children in care, but they make up about 2% of adoptions. So black children are overrepresented in the care system, and they're underrepresented in adoption figures.
Yeah.
So that might be because black children are coming into the care system at an older age, and therefore adoption is not chosen as a potential route for them. If that's the case, then okay, then we probably need to understand why black children are coming into the care system at an older age. That still doesn't really solve our problem. But I guess our Change His Future campaign, firstly, is about really trying to get to grips with what is going on for black and other ethnic minority children when they're being removed from birth families, what their experiences are in the care system, and what their experiences of adoption or not being adopted are. And I don't think that we've really got a good understanding of that.
We've got really limited data, haven't we? We know that the children wait longer, children of colour wait longer, but we don't know whether they wait longer and then are adopted into, families that reflect their ethnicity. Sure. We don't know whether they wait longer and then people go, oh, whatever, they'll just put them with a white family. So all of it seems like there's more the closer you look, you realise that we just know very little. So I know that this year's Adoption Week was the focus for all of the agencies. But actually, there's no sense of it making, it just raised more questions.
Yeah. Well, I think, and rightly so, I think the bits of data that we do have should really worry us. So black and ethnic minority children are waiting around 4 months longer for adoption. Black children, 4.6 times less likely to get adopted. So those small statistics that we do have should be red flags to say, hang on a sec, we really need to dig into this a bit further and get a much better understanding of what's happening for this cohort of kids in the system. The other thing that we found really interesting was we commissioned a ComRes survey of around 8,000 British adults, and it asked about kind of your propensity to adopt and then your concerns about the adoption process. And what we found was that black and ethnic minority people were twice as likely to consider adoption, but were much more likely across every single category to be put off during the process. So they were much more motivated, twice as likely to consider adoption, but they were more concerned about social worker treatment, they were more concerned about government digging into your paperwork, they were more concerned about financial concerns, more concerned about family, friends and community involved, like perspectives on adoption. And so essentially, if you think of prospective adopters in a kind of funnel, if you like, at the top level you've got loads and loads of people who are interested in adoption, but not enough black and ethnic minority adopters actually making it through the process. And so I think again that should be a red flag and should be asking, you know, prompting us to ask questions about what's going wrong in the system, and why are they not making it through, and what more could be done to support them through the system, so that for when it is important to get that ethnic match right, that's possible, and also just so we can have more people into the system in general.
Which is wholly commendable, because I think one of the things that I find intriguing is that there's very few, there's no one advocating for that work, is there? There's no community group, there's very few voices that are saying that or asking those questions, and I'm conscious that it's two white people you know, having this conversation, which kind of then just underscores the adoption community, really. But even, I guess, I know I know you well enough to kind of, you know, that I've even questioned adoption in of itself, but I know that that as an organisation, you know, when I read those scriptures, if we go back to scriptures, I see that there's a kind of a court, there's a, when we talk about the marginalised, we see that actually before children even get to that point of adoption, they come from communities and home environments where there's such a high level of deprivation or challenge or adversity. That actually, is that not, are we, you know, what's the old parable of the, you know, the, if you're fishing people out of the stream that are drowning, that's a great thing to do, but actually shouldn't you go upstream and find out why people are falling in?
It's a topic we talk about a lot, and I think the way I think of it is there's a whole landscape around the life of a child from, you know, birth through to adulthood, and at any stage in that child's life, any issue that they encounter, any vulnerability that they have is where the church should be. So we should be meeting people at their point of need. So whether that's, you know, another passion of mine from past life, if you like, is autism, and I think the church should be doing more in terms of making church a welcoming, friendly place for people who are autistic, for example. So I think whether it's you know, before children come into the care system, or when they're in the care system, or when they leave the care system through adoption, we have a responsibility to vulnerable children in their vulnerability to be there and to offer the support that's required at any stage in the process. There's an amazing organisation called Safe Families for Children. I don't know if you've come across them. They are a Christian organisation, and they mobilise a network of thousands of volunteers around the country. Yeah. And all of their work is before children come into the care system. So they're children on the edge of care, children in need. And it's entirely focused on trying to keep children at home with birth family, for, you know, and in a safe family for that child. And then, of course, the reality is that not every child will be able to continue to live with their birth family. And so when they come into the system, that's when our work sort of kicks in. And it's, you know, we have a responsibility then to be speaking up for those children, to be finding the families that they need, to be offering them the support that they need, and so on. Kind of segues also onto another project that we're doing called the Homecoming Project, which is all about...
There's more.
All around children living in orphanages around the world, what we know is that Christians are far more likely to be supporting orphanage care for children around the world. About 44% of Christians in the last year have given money to an overseas orphanage. Christians are 7 times more likely to visit or volunteer in an orphanage than other British adults. But what we also know is of the 8 million children living in orphanages around the world, 80% of them, on average, have got a living parent. So why are they not being supported to live at home with their parents? It's not because of abuse, neglect, and so on that they're coming into the orphanage system. It's generally because of poverty, or disability, stigma, and so on, that that a child is relinquished into an orphanage. And so we're, in that particular project, calling the church up not to house children in orphanages around the world, but to work with families on the ground to support them to raise their own children. And when that isn't possible, providing another local alternative family through fostering or local adoption.
I mean, that is a really interesting That is really interesting. And I would like to spend more time with that, but I'm not going to be drawn. You're drawing me into the long grass there with that one. But I do think it's highly laudable. But actually, in some ways, it kind of comes full circle back to that kind of that saviour complex of people, you know, international adoption that we sometimes see in different countries. I'm being careful. That we see that actually we'll go over and we'll save a little black baby on a really basic level, and then only to discover that when the baby grows up, it learns to speak English. It tells you, you know, you read horror stories of children who literally, when they learn to speak English, they go, "Oh, I left my mum and dad. You know, who are you? Why am I here?" And parents were told, you know, sold. It's literally, it's a money-making scam. And there's a great book by The Child Catchers by Catherine Joyce, which is a horrid book. Well, I'm not going to take up too much more of your time because I think you've been really open and honest, and it's really interesting. What I'm encouraged by is that you're stepping out of that. You're kind of, as an organisation, you're evolving and conscious of some of the pitfalls around faith. And because when the survey I got was broadly with what I was expecting, you know, a third of people who adopt have a faith, and that very few, I don't think any of them said, I heard there was a shining light and I felt God come down and say, adopt a child. It's more that people are living their lives that they're actually, they found their faith was something that supported them, and a couple of people really clear that my faith is hugely supportive. So, and that's another part of Adoption Sunday, isn't it, that you're hoping to build communities that are supportive of people who adopt and foster.
I had some amazing stories of churches doing all sorts of innovative things to support foster families or adoptive families in their local area. So there's one church who bought industrial irons so that when foster families came for their peer-to-peer support group in the church building, whilst they were having their peer-to-peer support, some of the church members were doing all their irons.
And do you have the name and number of that church?
It's in high demand. We have to keep it on the down low. Well, we absolutely want to call the church up to say, you know, when these families are raising children who have lots of different needs, can you be there at their point of need? Can you support them? Can you offer the local community that they need? A big part of Adoption Sunday is kind of asking people to think about what part they could play, not necessarily becoming a foster care or adopter themselves, but whether or not they can to do some of the support themselves, or whether they can advocate on behalf of those children and families through our kind of political advocacy work as well.
Excellent. Well, I hope you don't think I've not grilled you too hard, have I?
No, you haven't.
I'll have to try harder next time. I mean, there's lots more to talk about, and that would have been interesting. Perhaps the one thing, the contentious issue over the summer on Twitter was around adoptee participation and adoptee consultation, you know, adult adoptees. And is that something that, as an organisation, you've got links into adult adoptees or adult adopted people? Do they consult?
Yeah.
And your trustees, are any of them on your trustees or...?
Yeah, they are, yeah, yeah. So, again, one of my big passions from a past life was in the autism sector, and they were, you know, the advocates in that sector were so brilliant, really, at pushing that agenda, and would always talk about that concept of nothing about us without us. And so that's definitely something in our advocacy at Home for Good, you know, trying not to have any events where there's not that care experience or adoptee voice in the mix. You know, all decision making and so on, having those perspectives coming through, and trying not to speak on behalf of, but you know, genuinely engaging. And it's not easy in fostering and adoption, particularly when you're talking about young children, but we will stop at nothing. So we're trying all sorts of different things, and we'll continue to do so. It's so important. So
Well, that's excellent.
I'm with you on that one.
Excellent. Well, I think Phil and Scott will probably be happy with what we've done tonight. Do you think they'll be happy?
I hope so.
Yeah,
I hope
who
so.
Can tell?
You can have another
hour. Excellent. Well, thank you very much for talking to me, and I hope you... Will you be going to church on Sunday?
I will be.
Good.
I will
good
be.
Good Christian.
I want to prepare my Adoption Sunday spiel, actually.
Don't you have to do a turn?
I'm going to do a 2-minute talk.
Oh, that's excellent, isn't it? Yeah. I'll not be going to church because I believe my theology is that I am the church. So there you go. And my kids tend to eat pews and things. and break stained glass windows. Well, excellent. Thank you very much. And I look forward, I hope you have a great Adoption Sunday. And I look forward to speaking to you again in the future.
And you. Thanks for having me.
No worries.